Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friends Show. I am your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and I am coming to you from the dark right now as I have a scheduled power outage at my house. So apologies for the bad lighting if you are watching on YouTube. I'm joined today by Mr. Michael Morris. Michael, how are you doing?
Very well, thank you. From a delightfully balmy Cape Town, I must say.
Perfectly mild and slightly cool up here in Joburg, which is lovely, at least in my eyes. We also have Sarah Gon joining us. Sarah, how are you?
No, I'm fine. Thank you, Nick.
Very good to have you with us. Sarah will just have to pop off before the end of the show. So with that in mind, let us get straight into it. I think there's not that much news today, but there is a pretty interesting story, which is about the media and journalism in general. And that is from the Daily Maverick, which is, of course, one of the most important opinion journals in the country and also does some good investigative reporting. And they have shut down their website for today. And they say, if you go to the Daily Maverick pages today, you will see that we have shut down for 24 hours. We have never shut down before in nearly the 15 years we've been around. This was not an easy decision, but we felt compelled to highlight the global crisis journalism faces and what that means for our democracy and our economy. It goes on to talk about the massive reduction in the number of staff in newsrooms around the world, but with particular focus on South Africa, where there's been a recent huge reduction in the number of people who are working for media organizations. They go on to say, our cities are falling in lockstep with the demise of local journalism, with no accountability measures interrogating a broken system. Without that, our economy can't grow, business struggles to create jobs, and the tax base shrinks, creating a larger burden per person. As we are a national news site, there is a misconception that we are in every corner of South Africa. We are not. If we could hire more, we could change this. There is more than enough work to triple the number of journalists we currently have. Advertising revenue, grant funding, and philanthropic support are drying up. Your contributions have kept the Daily Maverick alive. And they reveal that they only have about 28,000 contributors who pay them some money every single month, but they get about 10 million page views per month, which is quite a lot more, as one can imagine. So they say that they're doing the shutdown for 24 hours to demonstrate what it would be like if there was a world with no reporting, no investigations, no updates, no accountability. And they encourage people who like their website to share the news. So this is an interesting question, and it's one that I know, Michael, you in particular know quite a lot about because you worked in the media pretty much your whole life, which is that there has been a very big financial problem facing many news organizations over the last couple of decades. And that's because people in the age of the internet like free media. They like to be able to go to a news site, not have to deal with a pop-up, to not have to deal with a login, to not have to deal with too many intrusive over-the-top ads. And yet at the same time, they've still demanded the kind of quality journalism that used to be pretty easy to pay for when newspapers made lots of money before the internet. Newspapers used to make an absolute killing, often through things like their classified section and things like that. But those things have all been wiped out and taken over by the internet now. And so media has been left with this big financial gap as they've tried to kind of, on one hand, keep people reading, on the other hand, square the costs of the fact that they make far less money. And there have been, I think, some fairly unfortunate results of this. I think the quality of a lot of journalism has gone down. I've often on this show complained about the reporting three tweets as a news story type of stuff, which happens from time to time. But there's still some good journalism that goes on out there, despite the financial problems. What do you make of this whole story, Michael? What do you make of this move by the Daily Maverick? What do you think?
It's, as you say, a very broad topic. Just as you were speaking, the idea of a newspaper not appearing, I remember probably in the early 80s, a crusty old sub-editor on the Cape Argus newspaper where I was a young reporter, coming up to me one day and saying, never use the word chaos in a story. Chaos in a supermarket because of a sale, or a chaos, you know, even a protest, chaos erupted. He said, don't ever use the word chaos. It means complete and utter mayhem, a complete destruction. The newspaper doesn't come out when there is chaos. So don't use the word chaos ever. And And of course, here we are with the newspaper not coming out, and it's a measure of the environment that we're in, and the environment the Daily Maverick has to operate in, that there is not chaos, that the world hasn't come to an end because the Daily Maverick has not appeared. It inevitably will be seen as a little bit gimmicky. And yet, on the other hand, I think it does underline a very serious journalistic situation. I remember probably 10 years into my career and being quite resistant to the idea earlier on of journalism being a business or newspapers being a business. To me, it was a much more earnest and noble affair than really a business. But about 10 years in, I began to recognize that a newspaper that is not financially independent cannot be politically independent either. And that's independent from business as much as from government. So the relationship between, and there was always a very strict division between church and state, the management of a paper and the editorial, the two more often than not detested one another. And that was a healthy thing. I think where that, and that's one of the consequences where some of the changes we've seen is that division has been eroded, and very often editorial decisions are made on the grounds of commercial considerations, which is a very bad thing. But one had a very clear sense in the old days of that division holding, and the newspaper being able to be robust and courageous and so on, but on the condition that it was independent enough to stand on its own 2 feet, and that meant it was selling in the marketplace. So the marketplace has changed. It's not anyone's fault. It's not the fault of the media market that it now has, you know, a very, very wide range of media products to choose from. It's an absolute cornucopia today compared to, you know, what it was in the 1980s. Everybody had to turn to a newspaper, I think, in those days. Now, you know, there's a terrifically wide range of things, and there are costs. I think you've suggested some of those, the quality and so on. Newspapers or traditional news organizations, even if they're online, wanting desperately to be hip and snappy and to try and somehow get a little bit of the cachet of the social media sphere and the immediacy of the digital media space. But ultimately, I think, you know, and I do think they're raising important concerns, and these are not to be taken lightly. But I do ultimately think if media companies are failing, it's because they haven't come up with a solution. You know, we're now 30 years into the digital era, and we still don't really have the kind of easy way you referred to paying, easy ways of paying. Kind of, you want to make it painless, as easy as clicking on something. That's how easy it should be to have a modest sum paid, however often. I mean, it's a very difficult thing, but it ultimately requires a business solution. Hectoring people about supporting investigative journalism is actually not going to do the trick. There has to be a much more serious-minded focus, I think, on the actual business model, rather than on telling people how important journalism is, which I agree with. I absolutely agree with that, and I think it is a crisis in some respects. But yeah, that's essentially what I think as an initial position. Yeah.
So, I mean, I think part of the problem here has been, so we have seen some successes in people coming up with new models of how to do media. You've got a lot of opinion journalists who have moved to forums like Substack, or sometimes they post on X/Twitter, where they can kind of point their readers through towards their opinion pieces or opinion they think is interesting. There has been, those sometimes also include investigative reports as well. And that's a very sort of slimmed down operation, right? Rather than being a whole company, you just pay a little bit of money to this thing, and then it's basically a coming together of a bunch of independently established journalists. We've also seen individual journalists, whether they're using a platform like YouTube or some other one to get people to fund them, directly and then going off to use that money kind of however they see fit. But the moment you kind of try to start scaling it up to something that can do the daily news, that I think is very much the place where everyone seems to be struggling. And there's definitely, I think, some mistakes that papers have made. And one of those has been in many ways, we were talking a little bit about this before in the pre-show, Michael, is that there's been a desperateness to kind of engage with social media, but often I think giving it too much credibility. I just always wish I could remember the specifics of this example because it's stuck in my head, but it was a newspaper story where they were reporting outrage at some event. And then it was in total, I think about 3 tweets in reply and then about maybe 10 people quote tweeting the original tweet saying, oh, this, you know, political party causes outrage. And then it's like, well, is 13 people really outrage? But that's very much a function of, oh no, we need to get a story up. There's only a very lowly paid junior journalist sitting there manning the desk. Oh, what are people talking about? People are talking about this. Okay, we'll throw it up on the website. Oh, look, it got quite a few clicks. So I guess it's a news story now. Sara, what do you make of this whole debate and the difficult place that media enterprises are in?
I agree with all of what Michael said. I think it's about focus, and I think there's a little bit of confusion in Daily Maverick. It sort of hops between investigative journalism, which is we all need, we'd all pay for, and I pay for Daily Maverick to see what they're doing, even the opinions to see what they're writing. But the opinions are so, it's not so much the ideology, which is, as has been pointed out, is distinctly left wing, but it's the quality is generally very variable. So that's a problem. But I think the biggest mistake in this particular action that Daily Maverick has taken, it's the classic thing of don't blame the customer. And the implication by the sort of, you know, you've got to get involved type of thing is the blaming of the customer. And it doesn't matter whether the customer's at fault or not, or whether you need new customers. You're a business. You've, as Michael says, you've got to make the effort to find a way to find that balance. Mm-hmm. And I think the problem is that when the general comment, if you see a lot of their emails setting out little, you know, reference to news items, and they comment on it, that is usually where I find the most offense, is that sort of somewhat arrogant, condescending snideness. And that's not good for your customer base. That can be in your opinions because they are the opinions of people. But that tone, and I think this, to some extent in its own way, although it raises very important points, reflects that.
So, Michael, one of the things my parents, who are both former journalists, complained to me about, and I think they definitely have a point here, is that there has been a trend in the last couple of decades of blurring the line between more, shall we say, dispassionate factual reporting and opinion. This is much worse in TV, I think, than it is in print, where, you know, it doesn't matter what news station you're talking to, but you'll have someone who's a news anchor who's actually an opinion anchor. They're there to give a point of view, but then sometimes they put on the hat of being a sort of factual reporter, and there's kind of, it all gets a little bit fuzzy, and that I think has contributed to people becoming more distrustful of older media establishments. Firstly, what do you think of that? And secondly, do you have any more thoughts on this?
Yeah, I think that is an important point. There's an irony actually attached to it also, to this extent that I think quite a lot of the sort of legacy media or established media or traditional media, also often called the mainstream media, has tended, I mean the more successful ones anyway, have tended to succeed in holding on to the idea that reporting is essentially a very different thing from opinionating. And And to that extent, the levels of trust are higher. Whereas a lot of the media that challenges them and accuses them of being, punting a particular line is so-called independent media, which is far from it. It's very sectarian media, which is only sort of advancing things from a certain point of view. But I do think you're absolutely right, and your parents are right. I well remember probably the late 80s, the shift towards, there was a word that was always used, towards what was thought to be more in-depth reporting or more substantial reporting, and they used to say you've got to provide the context, and that's fair enough. It probably is important to in a news story. It's not just a question of saying X said, Y said. These are the very bald facts. That's fine, and I think that worked pretty well in the 1920s, 1930s, 1940s. But the world changes and the media changes, and the media was changing at that point. And it was felt that what you've got to do is provide context, and that really opened the door to letting individual journalists allow their own perspectives to shape the story. And you'd see little things sort of creeping in. And there was this, an erosion of the barrier between what you could take as the factual reporting, which tomorrow might be added to or corrected, or as the case may be, and reporting that was actually not really reporting, but simply an expression of a point of view. And some of that worked very well. Some of it was very, very successful if it was in the hands of a really good pro, or she who, able to, in a way, alert the reader to this is what I'm thinking about what I'm seeing. But, in fact, what I thought was contradicted by the next thing that happened, which was this. In that way, you can write a very, very nuanced and interesting piece of work on something which is quite difficult to understand, maybe. But, and you can present all these different points of view. But if at the same time you're under commercial pressure and you are juniorizing your newsrooms, and you're cutting back on sub-editing, which is very often the very first casualty of that process, exactly what your parents are referring to, then what you do get is a hodgepodge of things, and the whole enterprise just becoming essentially untrustworthy and murky. Yeah,
I think that's definitely been the case. The way that I've always thought that it was supposed to work, and maybe this was naive or overly simplified, was that you have news reporting which tells you the verifiable, exactly what we can tell without much context, and then you've got opinion to give you that context to say, look, here's what happened and here's why this is important or not important or that kind of thing. That does seem to have broken down a bit. Also, I think there's just a bit of a problem of the fact that it's very easy to choose. You can choose the information you want to be eating now, so to speak. Most of the people who watch this show or any show on the internet or anything are here because they most of the time agree with us. We do have some people who disagree with us or watch us, but that's not unique to us. That's kind of all media these days. Just also means you've got a smaller market, that's less money to monetize. You have to kind of get people's energy up, which encourages you to write nonsense. You can extract more from it.
Maybe.
Go ahead.
Touching on that, the New York Times is not the newspaper it used to be, although every now and then one does have some insight into perhaps an old kind of journalism resetting itself. But certainly in the 80s, 90s, 70s, and before, they had a very, very strict policy of physically separating the opinion section from the newsroom, in the building. And there was just no contact. The people who were writing it, right, the leaders and editorials and main opinion pieces and so on, would sit and pontificate in their offices, or not pontificate, I can't think of the word I was looking for. Think about and prognosticate, whatever, and not be tempted to go down to the newsroom and ask questions or in any way be tainted by association with the other side of the operation. So that was a very interesting thing, and I mean that soon went away completely, and inevitably also under the pressure of the commercial considerations often you'd have managing directors saying, you know, we can't be so precious about the stuff. We've got to have newspapers that sell. We want to, you know, where's the front page lead that's really going to capture the public's imagination? And that's what people then began to look for. Instead of looking for the news, they were looking for that, you know, that great front page news, front page
exactly.
lead.
I believe at the Washington Post at one point, they've since taken it down. They had a giant board at the front of the office, which showed the number of collective clicks that each journalist's articles had managed to get. And there was like fierce competition to be at the top of the leaderboard. And this thing was completely destructive for their news, internal sort of news thing, because everyone was like just trying to do more and more extreme things to get up on the top of that list. And anyway, we can clearly, I think, talk about this for a long time, but let's move on to our next story for today. And this is about the Ingonyama Trust. Now, the Ingonyama Trust is essentially the mechanism by which the state, through the Zulu King, holds an enormous amount of land in KwaZulu-Natal. This is essentially the land of what under apartheid was the KwaZulu homeland. So there has been a research project into the Ingonyama Trust by the UCT Land and Accountability Research Center, which says that the trust is in fact not compliant with the Public Finance Management Act. They go on to basically say that the Ingonyama Trust has one trustee, and that is the Zulu King. But in effect, the land does sort of belong to the state. They have the sort of final say of it, because at the end of the day, they could take it away from the Zulu King. The trust holds about 2.8 million hectares of communal land on which more than 5 million people live. It was originally established in 1994 under the Ingonyama Trust Act. Since 2019-2020, the board of the trust no longer prepares the trust's financial statements in according with the Financial Management Act, which has apparently been accepted by the Auditor General. Information in relation to the trust income and spending of money is vaguely reported, and there's very dodgy sort of financial record keeping on a lot of this stuff. So the trust hasn't responded to this report yet. They said they needed to read through it to kind of come to a conclusion about it. But, you know, Sarah, there's some many bigger questions about the Ingonyama Trust, I think. And one of them is, you know, this is a thing that I think politically, particularly considering the current weakness of the ANC and KZN, the government has been very scared of touching, right? They don't want to get the Zulu monarchy mobilized against them. They don't want to get people who are benefiting from the system campaigning against them. But it's kind of mad that 5 million people are living on land that it effectively belongs to the state, that they will never be allowed to own, that the best they can hope for is a permission to occupy and kind of, you know, be sort of renters of the state. What do you make of this, Sarah?
Look, this sort of dispute has been around for a long time, and there's clearly the trust was formed as a political vehicle to, you know, for the Zulu hierarchy when it was formed back in the early days, and it's been generally poorly managed from a financial point of view, from all the auditing requirements, etc. And then, of course, and one of the problems is it's not owned by the trust, but they have been leasing people's land to them, which is, you know, is not part of the deal. It's not theirs to lease. And as you say, the inhabitants don't benefit one way. In fact, not only do they not benefit by ever owning the land and having it as capital to do what they need to do with it, but they're paying to tribal authorities money that they shouldn't be doing. So it's been, to a large extent, a little nasty political mess all the way. The problem, of course, now is that if the tribal authorities will, you know, you do not want to upset the king or their trusteeship when you've got Jacob Zuma breathing down your neck. And that's actually all your own fault. Speaking for the ANC, that's all your own fault. So the timing of this report should not please the ANC at all. It shouldn't please the the MK or Zuma, but MK or Zuma can ignore it for the time being, wait for the 6 weeks until the election. It's not going to affect their support, whether they're not seeming to support the people because the trust has been doing the wrong thing, or they're not supporting the trust because the trust will be doing something else. That, none of that matters. ANC, it matters not to be seen to be upsetting either Zulu people, Zulu authorities, trust authorities, or anybody. So the ANC is once again sort of caught with it's very bad planning, but it's terribly important that this be seen and be dealt with, certainly after the election. So nothing's going to happen before.
Exactly. Michael, what do you make of this thing? I mean, one of the proposals we've talked about, I think, before in the past is giving a lot of this land to the people who own it. Now, it's complicated because a lot of that land hasn't been properly demarcated, and who gets what, and dividing it into pieces would be very difficult. But, you know, the current situation is just not great at all.
Mm. No, indeed. And, you know, this whole concept is you know, it's not even old-fashioned. It's kind of archaic. The idea of a king being the kind of senior figure heading up this vast setup that ends up on the ground, meaning that, you know, all these millions of hectares are being occupied by people who don't have any rights and are beholden to, you know, this archaic authority. If you look at, just looking at the map in the ground up piece, the map of KZN with all the portions of the trust land marked in green, I mean, it's very extensive. And as Sarah rightly says, you know, what a difficult political hot potato for the ANC and the government to be presented with at a point when MK, I think, is very cleverly and nurturing a relationship with traditional leaders and the king, yes. and also the sense of nationalism, the kind of very particular kind of Zulu nationalism at the same time.
Also, the IFP has always been a supporter of the Ingonyama Trust as well.
Right, indeed. So it's you know, it's a kind of embedded in the politics there. So quite a difficult thing to deal with from that point of view. But something that we've written about, our colleagues, especially Terence Corrigan and Dr. Anthony Jeffrey, I think, over and over, in the debate about property rights and expropriation without compensation and land reform, which is the ANC's preferred term, or the term that's commonly used, here is, you know, very clearly an example of an enormous resource that could be used very effectively to truly empower people through property rights. I often think of the wonderful book, Why Nations Fail, by the economists Darren Acemoglu and Stephen Robinson. And on every third page, the thing that they emphasize right across history is property rights as the agent of societies that succeed. People, ordinary people in whatever society it might be, having the incentive to hold and own property and to benefit themselves. And here's a prime example of a resource that could, in fact, be used very, very effectively in this way to make an enormous difference to millions of South Africans.
Exactly. I would also add that I think that this is probably bad for the Zulu monarchy in the long term, but ultimately, by being kind of tied to the politics of the day and people's livelihood and things, is in the long term probably going to hurt that institution and may, in fact, end up being its downfall. So I think it would probably be in the long term interests of not just the people living on the land or the government or anyone really, but also, you know, the tribal authorities as well, to consider the fact that this thing is probably going to end up collapsing at some point, and it will be a disaster for absolutely everyone involved. You know, so it's better to move to a state where, you know, those institutions are focused on their kind of cultural and traditional role, as we've seen in many countries around the world, which is successfully pulled off having, you know, a monarchy and still being a modern state.
Exactly. And it certainly doesn't in any way, I don't think, undermine the potential, the very positive potential of monarchs to be a binding figure in a society.
Yeah.
But rather than a divisive one. Exactly. And that's always much more effective in free societies where people do, in fact, have protected property rights and so on. So, yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Yeah.
Okay. Let's go on to our last story. And this is funny you mentioned chaos at the beginning, because the headline of this one, I think it's a citizen piece, is Chaos at Lanesia South Hospital. and the title is No Water and Electricity. So according to some reporting by the Citizen, Lanesia South Hospital has, at least for the past couple of months, kind of had intermittent water and electricity. The situation, based on the reporting here, is really bad. Nurses on night duty fear for their safety and congregate in one room, taking turns to check on the patients using cell phone torches for light, essentially abandoning much of the wards to kind of whoever can come in. There's very little control over them. Clogged toilets. Friends of the patients have to bring them water per day, every day to take their pills. For meals, people are served basically some bread and vegetables, and that's about it. Psychiatric patients at night just sort of wander around the hospital doing whatever they like, and many of the other patients are terrified of them. And doctors aren't able to check up on people's vitals because there often isn't electricity to operate the machines. Now, this is a fairly horrifying story, and it's not a completely unusual one. We've heard this about South African hospitals, particularly in our more rural provinces, usually not in Joburg. But the worst part of the story comes at the end when it says, contacted for comment, the Provincial Department of Health spokesperson said he was not aware of problems plaguing the hospital and promised to investigate. Michael, what do you make of this?
Yes, I agree with you that that is the worst of it, and I can't help feeling that somewhere in the story I've lost it now, but so somebody refers to the fact that it has been chaotic, and I think chaos in this context does seem justified, even if that old sub editor of mine was thinking more in terms of its meaning in Greek, but For the department to say, well, we haven't heard anything about this, we can't investigate this in itself. Perhaps people do eventually just get used to things not working, nurses huddling in corners, doctors not being able to work. But I very much doubt it. I think it's just a complete irresponsibility and neglect that's happening here. And it's properly embarrassing, which is exactly what it should be.
Definitely. And kind of a bit ominous that something like this is being allowed to slide in an election year, when usually we at least get the sort of going through the motions or an attempt to quickly fix things up, at least before the election, which makes me even more worried, because the only thing worse than having a semi-responsive democracy is having an unresponsive non-democracy.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, I think with so many of these problems these days, one wonders if they're capable of doing much. I mean, where do you start for the entire hospital battling with water?
If our democracy was in a healthier state, a scandal like this should actually be enough by itself probably to bring down the government in at least the province, if not nationally. Yeah,
no, exactly.
And resignation. Now, we don't have time to talk about it, but Michael, you did actually write a piece with some reference to some of these themes. The opinion piece where you said low expectations across our society warrant closer attention. I think this may in fact be an example of that.
Exactly. Yeah. And people just having a sense that it really is worth voting. It really is worth making better choices or different choices. But they really do have to believe that is a possibility. And let's hope that as our democratic project matures, that we do achieve these, those incentives are.
I mean, I've heard it said before that, oh, what's the point? Things don't work. Oh, we're a democracy and it isn't working for us. I would say that the only thing worse than being a dysfunctional democracy is not being a democracy. I think there are many, many examples that I could point to prove that point, but we are out of time for today. So thank you very much for watching. We hope you found the show interesting. We'll, of course, be back tomorrow with the Daily Friend Wrap. I'm sorry I had to jump off quickly at the end here because she had somewhere to go. But thank you very much, everyone, for watching. And we will see you all tomorrow on the Daily Friend Show. Cheers.